Jesus taught the parable of the seeds that fell on different kinds of soil. Some fell on barren ground and therefore couldn't produce. Some fell on good ground and grew to mighty trees. And the same thing, he was using the parable as a reference to the truth, the same truth, but taken differently by different people, those who were receptive, those who were unreceptive. But we could apply this also to Kriya Yoga, that it depends on the technique, it depends on the blessings that come with it, it depends on the receptivity of the practitioner. That if we are ready, then we can get good results from it. Now the thing is that bad soil can be made into good soil. It's not as if he was condemning a whole lot of people as being incapable of receiving the truth. They, at that particular time, were not capable. In illustration of that, I saw on a map a few years ago the different kinds of soils in this environment. And I saw one area that was gray that indicated the worst of all the soil. All of it was bad. This was the worst. And I looked a little more closely, and it was exactly where our farm is. But with Honnell Cassidy's expertise in biodynamic gardening, he developed that garden into a very, very fertile, productive farm. And the same thing with us. We have to make ourselves fertile, so to speak. We have to make our soil receptive. And that means two things. Some people can sit down and start Kriya right away. The first thing they do in meditation, as soon as they sit, do their Kriya, and they go right into it. It's sort of like a powerhouse that draws them in. But if they aren't ready to go into that degree of inwardness and calmness, the same technique becomes just a mechanical practice and doesn't give them any effects. Now, if you can practice Kriya well, then it would be a good thing to begin your meditation with Kriya. That way you're sure to get in enough Kriyas, otherwise you might find that the time is slipping by. Kriya is the most important technique of all. If, however, you don't feel the results so easily, or if this happens to all of us, sometimes you feel a bit dull or restless or whatever, then it would be good to prepare the soil of your consciousness before you actually begin to practice your Kriya, to awaken these inner seeds, which otherwise won't even sprout, your karma won't be burned up and purified. And so, in the beginning, it would probably be good to practice other things first, the other techniques first. The path of inwardness is outlined in Patanjali's Eightfold Path, where he talks of the yamas and niyamas, first of all, then the asana, sitting absolutely still with a straight spine, pranayama, withdrawing the energy, pratyahara, interiorizing the mind, then concentration and meditation and absorption in the infinite. But first of all it all amounts to withdrawing from the outward in order to be able to rise into the inward. And in fact, we talked about overcoming our problems, as Lairi Maharshi said, overcome your problems with Kriya Yoga. We understand that the whole spiritual path has been described as an allegorical form in the Bhagavad Gita as a war between the forces of light and those of darkness, between our upward aspiring thoughts and qualities and those that pull us downward to toward matter. Now, when we think of war, we think of great deal of tension and violence. We think of either shooting like this or slicing with a sword or stabbing with a spear or whatever it might be, all of it involving lots of effort. Master, on the other hand, said that tests, karmic tests, can be overcome best by an attitude of calm cheerfulness. It's a whole different kind of winning on the spiritual path. I remember a young man on the path who was He thought at one time of becoming a wrestler, and he had a very strong, big body. And he was going through a test, and I remember him saying, because his orientation was toward the body, and he was saying, if only I could get my hands on it. But of course you can't. It's subtle. It's there behind your hands, behind your thoughts. How do you get into it? You see, it's a different kind of war. And in fact, you will find that the way to win is always by calmness. The whole spiritual path involves withdrawal. The qualities, Lahiri Mahashaya may have said, solve all your problems, but then we read about overcoming negative qualities, and you think, well, that's different. But it's not, because a negative quality isn't something you have to fight so much as to withdraw from. So you have a tendency toward anger, toward selfishness, toward lust, toward unkindness, toward all the different qualities that pull us downward into matter consciousness. You can't take that and chop away at it. What it is simply energy committed in a wrong direction. And the way out of that is to withdraw the energy. You feel angry. There's no point in getting angry with yourself for being angry. You go in circles. You just say, now wait a minute, why am I getting angry? There's nothing to be that excited about. Anger comes from frustrated desire. Well, give up the desire, and you realize that anger is really a sort of a childish incapacity for facing reality. If things are the way they are that make you angry, then that's how they are. And why not just learn to adjust to the fact and then see what you can do about it on yourself, on others, but in ways that will work, not in ways that will agitate everybody. Somebody was asking me whether we do anything in political action, in the ways of political action, for example, ecology and so on. I said, we do a lot more than most people realize, because we don't have to get out there and march and get angry. I said, anybody who is trying to, for instance, tell those people in Brazil that they're doing a bad thing chopping down the Amazon forest, which of course they are, and I think I'm certainly as worried about it, concerned about it, as anyone else. I can't say upset. After all, I don't lose sleep over it. But I know it's wrong, and I'd like to do whatever I can to change it. But now, put yourself in the shoes of somebody going to Brazil and telling those people with great anger, this isn't how you should do it. They're going to say, oh yeah. And then you'll just have a big battle. The way to do it is with calmness. The best way you can work for ecology is to be harmonious. But to fight for harmony with nature in disharmonious ways, that's unecological. We have to put good vibes into the world. And that way we create harmony, and man automatically lives in nature, in harmony with nature. If everybody lived the way we live, we wouldn't have a problem with ecology. It isn't so much that you have to think about all the various things to be done as your attitude. And the same thing is true with bringing peace on earth. If you're peaceful, you're generating a great deal more power for peace than if you angrily protest and march on Washington declaring various things angrily because you feel they're doing it all wrong. Change yourself. Change your relation with other people. And then let that vibration, and if you have the capacity to speak, let those words go out. But that's the way to do it. We've had a century of trying to change the world through politics, and look where it's got us. I think we've got to change it through spiritual consciousness. I think we've got to raise people's consciousness. Sure, it won't take as long, but look at the shortcuts they've taken, and where do they take them? It's like going into a maze. You think this is a little shorter, but it goes to a dead end. You have to come back and try another, and another, and another. No, the way out of every battle with delusion is, first of all, withdrawal into the divine. Everything good that comes into this world comes from above. Everything restless and disharmonious comes from below, comes from the confusions of matter involvement and subconsciousness. All inspiration, even the inspiration of those people who have not been tied with spiritual consciousness, that is to say, the scientists. Many scientists themselves will say that they don't believe in God, but great scientists either believe in God or manifest Him without knowing it. because every one of them has received his insights and inspirations as if in a flash from some higher source, and many of them recognize it. Einstein said that the secret of all great scientific discovery has been a sense of mystic wonder, awe before the greatness of the universe. It's in that mood, in that frame of consciousness, that great discoveries and great insights come. And that's why all great men in any field, men and women obviously, I mean, all of them have received their inspiration from above, not from this little brain. That's why the whole thing of IQ and genius is just a totally misunderstood thing. Genius is not how intelligent you are. Genius is not having the cleverness to figure it all out. It's having the openness to receive from above. That's where our solutions come from inside, from a higher level of consciousness. So, in order to prepare for deeper meditation, the path is simply this. And all the yamas, niyamas are basically that too, the do's and the don'ts on the spiritual path. They are a matter of withdrawing from delusion. They say, non-desire to tell lies. If you don't have a desire to tell lies, then naturally you're truthful. Non-covetousness, because if you don't covet, naturally you're complete in yourself. All of them have that same thing of relaxing. Master said the path is first one of relaxing from the world outside, relaxing from your problems, relaxing from the attachments and plans and projects that you have and so on, into yourself. This is the first thing to do. That's why Jesus said, if when you go to the temple to pray, you have anything against your brother, straighten it out with him first and then pray. What he meant basically was, after all, you may not be able to straighten it out with your brother, because even if you come to him peacefully, he may answer angrily. Then do you have to delay going to the temple until he gets it together? No. Basically what he meant was that be peaceful toward your brother. Be peaceful toward the world. Emanate kindly vibrations. That's why in the Indian scriptures, the Gayatri Mantra is so often said before meditation, because it's a prayer for the enlightenment of all beings. May all beings receive this light in all the three worlds. Om Bhurbhuvaha Swaha, Om Tatsavitarvarnyam, Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi, Diyo Yo Naha Prachodayat. Om. And then beginning it with Om, ending it with Om. Beginning it with the divine consciousness, ending it in the divine consciousness. Realize that the practice of Kriya is a totality that embraces all of your life. And the more you can bring your life into harmony with Kriya, the more you'll find your heart, your Kriya working with your life, and you'll find that it comes like a natural thing. In fact, Kriya is something that you should find a moment here and there to do any time during the day that you're free. Master used to say, instead of sitting around gossiping, telling jokes, go out alone into the garden and practice two or three Kriyas. Do six Kriyas. Any time you have a few minutes, do a few Kriyas. You'll find yourself coming back to your center. It's a very good thing to do. Now, begin by withdrawing. When you sit in meditation, it would even help you mentally to construct a fire. And just throw into the fire all your attachments, all your projects, and just let them be. Just be free inside. Another good thing that will help you to get into Kriya is all the various things Master told us in preparation for meditation. Facing east, because the magnetism of the earth, the vibrations that come from the east, help us to calm ourselves more easily. If not east, north is also all right. It doesn't mean that if you can't face east or north, you can't meditate. These are helps. They're not absolutes, not categorical imperatives. Having an altar so that your focus can be on the altar. A certain amount of ritual can be helpful in getting the mind focused. But then you have to understand that the real ritual is the offering of your inner energy on the altar of infinity. Another thing then is to have the same place to meditate where you gradually, and you don't do anything there except meditate, because gradually you build up vibrations of peace in that place, so that after a few months, just going into that little room, or into that little screened-off portion of your bedroom, just sitting there, automatically you will feel more like meditating deeply. And all of these things will help to take you into that mood. Another thing that will help is to have the same time that you meditate every day. Because then when that time comes, it's sort of like Pavlov's experiment with dogs. Whenever he rang a bell, the dog began to ensalivate. The gastric juices began to flow. Well, the same thing is that when that time comes, just as if you eat at the same time every day, when that time comes around, without even looking at your watch, you find that you're hungry. So with this, if you meditate at the same time every day, without looking at your watch, you'll find that's when you suddenly feel like dropping everything and rushing off to meditate. These are all helps. Chanting is a great help. This is why we pray to the masters, because we ask them to be with us in our practice. It would help you to feel that the master is sitting right there beside you, or even inside you, that your body is his body, and he's doing kriya through you, perhaps, let's say. Or that he's sitting in front of you and admonishing you, now do it this way, no, not like that. But any way that you can try to bring his consciousness there so that you feel that he's guiding you, that's his purpose. The real function of the guru is much less what he says outwardly, what he does outwardly, much less that than the inward guidance that he seeks to give you if you are receptive. And there again, it can help to meditate a little bit before kriya, to get into that receptivity, to get into that attunement. So first of all, let the world go. Just sort of tell yourself that, after all, when I go to sleep at night, I let the world go, and I know it'll be there in another few hours. I don't have to worry about it. So when you sit to meditate, pretend you're going to sleep, in the sense of, well, don't pretend too hard. Some people do. First thing they should do to sit and meditate, and then with great devotion start bowing to the altar. But just tell yourself that the world is not yours anymore. This is your world. You're in another world. Just even tell yourself, well, supposing I were to die, I'd have to leave it all behind. Now I'm dying. And at this moment, I'm dying. In fact, Lahiri Maharsha used to say that every time you do kriya, it's like dying and being reborn. Every kriya, in fact, is like that. If you take it that way, death is often been said, even in the West, as being the small sleep has been the small death, hasn't it? Well, every breath is a small death. Every time you exhale, you can take that as letting the world go. Every time you inhale, taking on the world again. And every time you do kriya, you can do it that deeply. And going into meditation can be another kind of dying. Just for now, this world no longer exists. Then the next thing is to relax your body. And it's marvelous how these techniques and these teachings tie in with the totality of life. For example, Master said that to relax your body, inhale first, tense the whole body, throw the breath out and relax. Why, if you want to relax, do you tense first? Well, because when the tension is just a little bit, you don't notice it. And so a lot of your body's tense without your being aware of it. When you increase the tension, you become aware of that tension. And then when you can relax it consciously. Another thing is that you sort of equalize the flow of tension all over the body and thus release the tension in those parts where you weren't aware of it so much before. Now then, how do we apply this to daily life? Well, it's an interesting karmic fact. Interesting fact of karma, I should put it rather that way, that before a particular karma is about to end, let's say you're going through a very bad spell, just before it's about to end, it's sort of like students of painting. They're told that when you have a body, let's say, with shadow on this side and sun on this side, that part of the shadow that is at the line of where the sun touches it, is darker, they have to paint it darker than here. That's how the eye sees it. The same thing is true with karmic tests, that very frequently, it's a norm really, that just toward the end it gets worse and then suddenly gets better. just toward the end of good karma, that also can happen. And that's why in India they try never to make things perfect, because they figure once it's perfect, it'll start going downhill. They have the statue of Jagannath with the arms cut off, and in the Bokhara rugs, the classical Bokhara rug always has one little mark that is imperfect, deliberately imperfect. My parents had a Bokhara, and all the little ovals around it were dark-colored, blue and red. There was one little white color. Didn't have it. The idea possibly was that too. Whatever the case, the fact is that life itself teaches us this lesson, that before there's a relaxation, before there's a release, there's an increase of tension. And so you can take it this way. You can, even when you're having trials and troubles and so on, just sort of inwardly tense, inhale, tense hard, throw the breath out and relax, and just see parts of your body that are tense without your even knowing it become more tense and then relaxed. If you tense your body like that, which is really the sort of starting point for all these outward emanations, inhale and tense the whole body, throw the breath out and relax, then somehow you relax your hold on these things, and they no longer are as real. Master taught that in the lessons as a technique for overcoming worry, for example. He said, inhale, tense hard, throw the breath out and relax, and then keep the mind empty, blank in a sense. He said never let the mind go blank. So what he meant was just completely without thought, but not without feeling or awareness, without thought. And then when thoughts try to crowd into the mind again, then you've sort of given them a little moment to change gears. Fill the brain with positive thoughts, maybe some happy memory of a picnic you went on years ago, or somebody whose friendship you cherish, or something like that, that crowds out these negative thoughts. So here's one way in which the energization exercises and the practice of tension and relaxing, tense with will, relax and feel, as Master taught, we can apply that to life as a whole. And I told you yesterday about Hong So. The same thing. All of these things can gradually help us to become calm. If you've got a problem in your life and you just remember Hong, the Hong is the mantric word, but the Sanskrit word on which it's based is aham, I. The ahankar is the ego. So I, when it's said as Hong, is a dissolving of the I, and So means he, the infinite. I am he is the meaning of the mantra. And so whenever you have a problem, just in saying Hong So, feel that gathering tension in the problem released into So, gathering and released, and it'll become more and more. So you can use Hong So also to release the world and get more relaxed into yourself. The whole point of it is that Kriya either can take you at your center and be so magnetic that it draws everything into it. That's great if you can do it, but if you can't, or if the day is not suitable for it because you're feeling a little out of sorts, whatever it might be, then practicing this technique of withdrawal, of Hong So, listening to the Om, getting very centered, then do your Kriya. Don't do Kriya when you're emotional. Wait until you're somewhat calm and then practice it. So these are sort of lines that you can follow in your daily practice, although sometimes you can follow them quickly. Sometimes it's very easy to say, okay, goodbye world, goodbye body, dump the body, as Master said, just drop it in breathlessness is the way he put it, but that may not be as easy for the majority of devotees. Okay, just drop it, forget about it, go into the inner silence, and then begin your Kriya. If you can do that, fine. If not, follow these other lines. Now, beginning Kriya bands would be good. It would be good for them to do these various things. Otherwise, their tendency is to come at Kriya from outside, and then they face nothing but frustration because they never seem to get it right. Try to get to, when I talked about getting it from inside out yesterday instead of outside in, I was talking about becoming so relaxed that you become centered right here in yourself. Now, with that centeredness, then what should you do? Well, Master gave us a line that would be good for people to practice. It's not the technique itself, but it helps you to get into the spine. And don't presume that you can be there quickly. If you're at all restless, you won't be. These will help you to get there. The simple thing of inhaling and exhaling through the fists is a means of helping, because the tactile sense is better developed in the palms of the hands than it is in the throat. You can feel the cool and warm more readily here. So if you inhale and exhale through the tube that you make with your fists and concentrate on the feeling of coolness, then do it in the throat and feel that is cool. Visualize it strongly as being cool in the throat. Then do that just quickly. Like that, three times. Then transfer. The throat and the spine, after all, are very close together. And mind you, the spine is not those bumps that you feel on your back. Where the spinal column goes, where the nerves go, is much more toward the center of the body. It's not the outside. And so the currents you're going to feel much more inside the body, right close to the throat, right close to this whole wind passage. So feel feel that coolness, first of all, coming up quickly, just next to the throat itself, next to the wind passage. So it'll only go a little bit here. One count. Then do it three counts. From the bottom up, or from wherever you feel, because you're trying to get into the feeling of it. So you don't have to start at the bottom if it doesn't come naturally, but start where it comes naturally, and then start a little bit lower and a little bit lower. Try to get into the flow of it. It's a matter of intuition more than anything else. That's why Kriya is not only a science, it's also an art. Many people go to art school, but few become artists. And you can learn all the science of mixing colors, and that doesn't make you an artist. The art of it is a scientist too. Many scientists learn the same things, but how many are able to make those things work? They have to have a certain amount of intuition too. Luther Burbank was criticized by his fellow botanists and biologists because he was able to make experiments work that none of them could replicate. But the reason is that he was so indrawn. In fact, it was said of him that he would keep his eyes up here and his eyes would be half open and half closed. And he would be very internalized as he did those experiments. And so he was able to make the plants respond in a way that somebody who came in a merely mechanical way wouldn't. Do your Kriya that way too. Now, the cool and warm, don't wait for them to happen. But make them happen. That is to say, that's what will happen in time naturally, but in the meantime, tell yourself, first of all, do it one thing at a time. You've got a sound, you've got a feeling. Try to get the feeling first, because that's what you're concentrating on. So in the spine, make that cool come up. Concentrate on its being cool, on making it cool, rather than thinking that the breath is going to make it happen automatically. The greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. Remember that principle. It's the cornerstone of these teachings. Master taught it for the energization exercises, but it's something that we need to apply to the teachings on every level. When doing Kriya, you must do it with will. And will does not mean gritting your teeth and straining. It means willingness. It means really wanting to feel, creating that cool feeling and that warm feeling. And then, with that, concentrate on the awe to create it as a big feeling coming up, a full feeling in the tube, and a very thin thread-like current coming down. Now, it would be good for you to think, to become aware of the energy in the spine to a certain extent, or at least the reality of the spine, before you begin your Kriya at all. To visualize a tube there and concentrate on that being a tube. One thing that will, in fact, our chant of Om, 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 all the chants that we do in the chakras. It's an easy way to remember the positions, and a good practice to sort of get yourself centered in the spine. But the most important practice is Mahamudra. And this is a technique to be practiced, because this magnetizes the spine. This makes your spine ready to receive that current of Kriya when you do it. And without Mahamudra, you're sort of beating about in the dark. Mahamudra is an important technique, and that's why it's given as a part of the initiation rather than as some sort of a technique apart from the initiation. Mahamudra magnetizes the spine. When you do Mahamudra, you should concentrate in the spine and concentrate on pulling. You know, there's a Mahamudra technique in Hatha Yoga, but that's different because it doesn't tie in more so closely with Kriya. But anytime, even in Hatha Yoga, that you have mudras as opposed to asanas or positions, postures, the difference between a mudra and an ordinary yoga posture is that the yoga posture is not intended to awaken energy, but only to loosen you up so that the energy can flow later. Or, well, even then, but it's not concentrating on the energy, it's concentrating on relaxing so that you open those passages. In the mudras, you can do that too, but the main purpose of the mudra is to directly act upon the energy itself. In the yoga postures, for example, when you do the head to the knee pose, which is very similar to the first and second positions of Mahamudra, in the yoga postures, in Karnapirasana, you bring the head down to the knee, but you relax into that position. In Mahamudra, you don't relax into that position. You relax a little bit forward, but then you exert a pull, because with that resistance here, you get energy, you feel the energy in the spine. So you want to feel the energy in the spine, and you want to feel it going up here. This is why, and that position of the head to the knee pose is really just sort of, I would imagine, borrowed from this thing, because it's you putting the forehead down on the knee is to bring the energy here to the spiritual eye while bringing the energy up the spine. Now that's the purpose of Mahamudra. Mahamudra is stretching forward and bringing the knee down, if possible, to the kneecap, so that you feel the energy in the spine and then feeling it rising up toward this point. In doing Kriya, your point of reference is here. That's why we pause here. We don't pause here. At least we don't concentrate here. Somebody said, can't you concentrate? Why don't you stop at the bottom? Is it not allowed to stop at the bottom? I said, no, that's not it. It's that we don't want to make a dogma of not stopping, but you can certainly stop to get more comfortable. That's the time to stop, if you want to just cough or something like that. But there's nothing to concentrate on down there. It's up here that you want to concentrate. So your Kriya, it's as if you were doing it always in reference to this point. Now, the seat of the ego is here in the medulla. You all know that. I don't need to explain it in at length today. But when you concentrate here and look forward to that point, you'll find that brings the connection best. So don't bypass this point in bringing your attention here. Let it be up through the ego and offered to the spiritual eye. That's why with Kriya, we bring the Kriya current up through the medulla, turning at the medulla, going through the brain to the point between the eyebrows. So now then, when we do Mahamudra, resist with your spine, pull, but resist so that you feel the energy there. Pull on it, don't just relax into it. How straight should your legs be when you do Mahamudra? Ideally, of course, your legs should be straight. That way you get a good pull at the base of the spine. You should drop your chin to the chest. That way you get a big, good pull at the top of the spine. There's a pull all the way along the spine that way. But some people can't touch their feet even without bending their knees. Others can do it, but there's so much pain under the knees that their minds are there instead of here. In that case, it would be better to let the knees be bent a little bit. You get much more of a pull on the foot than you would if you were grabbing the ankle, let's say. You can get much more of a traction that way. Master corrected me, interestingly to my mind, because in the lessons it always said just pull on the toes or on the feet. But when I was demonstrating Mahamudra for an initiation that Master gave for 400 or 600 people, a large crowd, in front of all those people, therefore I think he was telling it for their benefit, not just for mine personally, he told me to link the fingers like this, and then to pull on the big toe, because he said there's a certain, it has something to do with the way the energy flows in the body. So the ideal way would be that. If you can't pull on your big toe, if you can't link your fingers, clasp your hands together like this, then just pull. The main thing is the pull and the concentration here. How long should you hold Mahamudra? Well, Master said to do it, count Om 6 times. Don't count 1, 2, 3, 4, but count Om 6 times. You can go up to 12 if you like, but don't hold it too long, because you want to be able to see how important is the breath with Mahamudra. It's important not so much as a Kriya breath, which is when you're sitting properly and going deeper and deeper with each Kriya breath. It's more important as a means of completely centralizing yourself, centering yourself in the spine, so that your mind isn't out here on what you're pulling. It's from here that you're doing it. In fact, it would be a good thing in doing the yoga postures in general, in doing Mahamudra in particular, to be graceful so that you have the feeling that what you're doing is coming from inside out, so that you're not sort of throwing your foot out there and grabbing it any old way, but coming out there and grabbing it gracefully and then coming back gracefully, so that you have this feeling of being centered here, moving out from that center. Ideally, you don't breathe between the movements. That's another reason for not holding it too long. But if you have to, then it's not a terrible thing. It's just better if you can do it without. If on the other hand, it means that by the time you've reached the third movement, you're like this, then better don't worry about it too much. Two or three Mahamudras. You'll get much more benefit if you do. You were saying you found much better three than two. And that's certainly so. You can do more. Those of you who have been doing Kriya longer, you can do Mahamudra 15 minutes at a time if you like. There's no harm in it. It's a wonderful... Why is it called Mahamudra? I've explained the meaning of mudra, but maha means? Great, exactly. That means of all the mudras, it's the great mudra. Why would this be called the great mudra? Because it's so all-embracing in its benefits. It can help cure you when you're ill. It can help bring you back into a sense of well-being when you don't feel quite right. It makes you centered perfectly here, and then it brings, because of that, everything into harmony with that center. It strengthens the flow of energy in the spine, and also bringing that energy outward from the spine into the whole body. It equalizes the energy in the whole body. It's a great technique. And Keshavananda, I learned, used to do it an hour at a time every day, and develop great magnetism that way. So if you want to do more, there's no harm as long as you don't cut down on your meditation time. Most of us in America haven't the time to devote all day to meditation, and therefore we have to cut down our time accordingly. But anyway, do two or three Mahamudras, because if you don't, you'll find it much more difficult to get your Kriyas right. Mahamudra, again, to reiterate this important point, it's given as a part of the initiation because it's a part of Kriya. It's not something that will help you when you get around to doing your Kriya. The same thing is true with Jyotimudra. We'll get to that after a little bit. Anyway, with Mahamudra, you practice that preferably before you start your meditation, but not necessarily. You can get the benefit of it if you do it a little bit previously. For example, we come here to meditate None of us did Mahamudra here. It's not a convenient place to do it. You go to the chapel, the temple. There are a lot of non-Kriyabans there, and they're wondering, what are all these contortions going on? I guess I'll do my exercises too. And before you know it, you've pretty well shot that meditation. And so better to do it at home before you come. Before you do your Mahamudra, it's good to say just a quick prayer to the gurus. Bless my practice. Just sort of an offering of your practice, the way you do when you bless your food. Offer it up to God and do it in a prayerful mood so that it's not just for you a physical exercise. So before you sit to meditate or immediately before you do Kriya, that's really a matter of personal choice. There are a lot of things here that we don't want to make categorical because they depend upon you. How you feel inspired to go, what you feel like doing. For example, if in the middle of your kriyas you suddenly have a vision of Babaji, well, don't, for God's sake, say, well, I'm sorry, I'm not ready for you. I've got to finish my kriyas. That's what you were doing your kriya to get. So drop your kriya and just be absorbed in that vision. You have some wonderful experience, and forget the practice and go into that experience. You have to follow your own common sense and your own intuition and your own, the way you feel that particular day. Sometimes you feel like doing other techniques first. Sometimes you feel like getting right into Kriya. There can't be a hidebound, hard and fast rule on this thing. It's got to be individualized by you. And also, there are lots of little things that you'll discover that will help you, but might not be something to tell somebody else. And so in our meeting with the light bearers the other day, several of them mentioned a few of these points. I said, that's good for you if you find it helpful, but don't, we have to give this technique the way Master taught it. And so we don't want to keep intruding other things that for others could be merely a burden. It's not necessary. Let them find out their own particular little things that are helpful to them. Now, when you begin your Kriya, it would be good to really be conscious of the energy at the base of the spine. Give it a good tug from the start. Just don't sort of get on the train or on midway up the spine. Start at the beginning station. So, I know Oliver Black used to say, do a sort of a glottal stop at the start. Master didn't say it, and so I don't, but it's worth sharing with you in case you find it helpful. He would go, oh, like that, instead of, normally the H is the way Master taught it, and therefore I don't want to share it with you as a thing to do so much as to make you conscious of beginning from the start, the way that at H sound is to give an extra tug at the beginning to get it going. Visualize it very clearly as a cool feeling, first of all, and then let the sound support that cool feeling in coming up and the warm feeling coming down, the E sound. How do you make the A and the E? I know many of you went through this yesterday in your practice. Let me just share it with you anyway to reinforce your memories on it. It's an internal sound. Somebody wrote me a question. Your mouth didn't move while you were doing it. It didn't seem as if it was open. Well, that's another thing I would like to touch on briefly. But first of all, the not moving with it open, the sound is because the sound is in here. You don't do like that, and you don't do like that. It's in the throat. You'd never be able to read my lips on this one. Because it's here, right? When you do your Kriya, do it as if the sound were here. When you get the E sound, it's as if it were sort of up under the ear. It's not with the tongue or the teeth. Important, because you want to get this thing inside. You don't want to have an outward sound. It's an inward sound that helps the inward flow. So then, the more you can relax in the spine, but in relaxing, don't be passive. In relaxing, feel yourself in the deep spine, but then with great will, great willingness, bring a cool, make that energy cool. Make that sound come strong, that feeling come strong. Bring it up the spine with willpower. Bring it up to the medulla, and then offer it from the medulla to the point between the eyebrows. When you feel it coming down, feel it coming specifically from here back to the medulla, and then start the downward flow. Master taught that, and this is something for beginners don't do, but later on as you get into it, do it. Chant mentally Om at each chakra as you come up. Now that's hard to do in the beginning because you're told awe, so what's this with Om? But once you've got the awe and the E sound, then you can do the Om without any disturbance because the awe and the E become more or less automatic. Again, with counting, it isn't as if you have to count like this, nor do you have to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 12 or whatever. It's more that you do it to get the rhythm, and once you've got the rhythm, stay at that rhythm, but don't think of counting. How fast did you count? Master said if you're doing it faster than 10, you're not doing Kriya. 10, about that speed. So do it at least 10. The slower the better. The slower the better. Up to 15, Master said, you can even do more. Really deep Kriya will be very slow. But the thing is, you don't want to get out of breath. You don't want to have to breathe between Kriyas. And so you have to do it in that kind of rhythm that will enable you not merely to get to the end of that Kriya, but keep going in the same rhythm. And the same thing is true. Somebody asked me the question, if I like to stay at this point between the eyebrows longer than 3 counts. Well, Master said 3 to 5. He said to pause here, but don't pause more than that. Why? Because if you can pause more than that without getting out of breath, then do your Kriya more slowly. You'll get more effect out of it if you do it more slowly. Deep, slow Kriya is the best. However, do pause here 3 to 5 counts. Just again, without counting, or you can just say Om, 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 like that, and then begin your downward, your descent. Now, don't, when you're doing Kriya, don't stop in the middle of a Kriya, or if you do, cancel that Kriya and start again. I don't mean cancel the whole session of Kriya, it's just that particular Kriya. Don't, if you swallow, for example, if you cough, if you fidget, your mind's distracted, then you've sort of ruined that Kriya. Start it over again. If, on the other hand, all your Kriyas are ruined, you can't go on doing Kriya all day, so there's got to be a common sense compromise. But if you can do it in a steady flow, that'll be best. Don't be tense here. Some people, when they're doing Kriya, get all like that. You'll have vocal problems in time if you do that. Just be really relaxed in the throat, and you'll find that the sound comes easily. Once that flow is easy, then if you mentally touch each chakra on the way up, it'll not only help to make your flow specific, but it'll also be a good means of really keeping the energy right in the spine. A very good practice. Be relaxed in the spine. Feel as if your whole being were centered there. The more you can do Kriya deeply, the more it will be awakening the Kundalini. The more it will be operating upon the Sushumna, which is where, Master said, the real spiritual work begins. It's once you're in the deep spine that you then really confront the positive and negative forces within yourself and can get to work on them. And until then, it's all sort of vicarious in a way. Working on it out here, hoping it'll have some influence here. But the real work begins here. Don't be discouraged. There are many stages on the path. One disciple of Ramakrishna said that, he said, I used to think that the spiritual work is finished when you finally attain Nirvikalpa Samadhi. He said, I find now that I've attained it that that's where it begins. So, it's a long way up there. The wonderful thing about it is that it's not an empty desert. Till you finally reach that oasis, it's a land that becomes more beautiful every day, more thrilling every day. And in fact, that's, they say, is why souls that are not very highly advanced cannot advance spiritually in the astral world. It's so beautiful, there's no incentive. They have to come down to this imperfect world to have the incentive to grow, to make the effort to find a perfect world in God. Well, now, there's another thing I talked about briefly, and this is something which maybe those who have been doing Kriya less than 3 years should close your dainty little ears and not listen to me. However, since I don't see anybody doing it, but rather they're all like this. there is a practice which is actually quite important. Why didn't Master teach it? Because probably nobody would have practiced Kriya if he had. There are certain aspects of Kriya and of yoga that are so esoteric and so strange that even the Kriya breath that we have, which is great, is already enough for a lot of people to sort of not get around to doing it every day. I won't say, am I right? and you should do it every day. You know, I've had Kriya now for nearly 42 years. I haven't missed a day except when I was ill. And I've done it all but maybe 3 days, twice every day. It's something that I committed myself to, and whether it went well or badly, I still did it with the faith that if it went badly, eventually it would get better, and I'd get through those periods. I remember there was a period of a year and a half toward the beginning of this path when I actually hated Kriya. I hated going into... I was afraid of peace for some reason. It was some delusion that hit my mind, and yet I believed in it, and so I said, well, I'll do it anyway. And I just didn't care about how I felt. I just did it because it was my duty. I had to grin and bear it. It was not what I wanted. But then it passed away. And if I hadn't done that, it wouldn't have passed away. So however you feel today about it, have the faith that these great masters know what they're talking about. And they've attained something great. And if you want to attain it, then believe what they're talking about. This technique, however, is one that is, it's a part of Hatha Yoga also. It's said to be one of the tests of whether you've become perfected in Hatha Yoga. But Hatha Yoga is, in fact, the physical branch of the science of Raja Yoga. So it's really not a separate yoga at all. It's just the physical part, physical aspect of the meditative science. And the whole purpose of Hatha Yoga is to get you into deeper meditation. In fact, the very word Hatha, it relates to these two currents, Ha, Tha. This is the meaning of the word Hatha. So it relates really to the inner energies. And the postures are intended to help to awaken those inner energies. The basic difference in approach between Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga as two separate systems is that Hatha Yoga gets below Kundalini and pushes it up. Raja Yoga gets above and creates a magnet of devotion and concentration that draws it up. And Hatha Yoga can be dangerous if you go into it without proper teaching. If you want to go into it this deeply, if you want to just practice a few postures, that's fine. But if you're wanting to practice Hatha Yoga for Kundalini awakening, then don't do it on your own, because this could damage your nervous system if you awaken that energy before the rest of it's been prepared to receive it. Now, anyway, this particular technique is called Khechari Mudra, and the technique is... It's something actually that some animals do when they hibernate. Their tongue goes back and behind the soft palate, and it puts them into a trance state, into a state where their pulse is very, very slow, and they can live off of the fat of the body for all winter because their whole metabolism has been so slowed down. Well, yogis practice this in order to withdraw the energy from the body and really internalize it. It's sort of like a short circuit. It creates a flow, a circuit of energy here rather than going out into the body. So this technique is to bring the tongue back. And Master hints at it in the lessons, where he talks of turning the tongue back to broaden, to expand the throat. Where he talks of, when he talks of the higher techniques, certain turning the tongue back. But he doesn't go further in the lessons, because he's trying to bring people stage by stage, as I'm trying to bring you today, to that point where they can practice it effectively. Once he said to Dr. Lewis, you're not doing Kriya correctly. Dr. Lewis said, what do you mean, sir? Master said you should be doing it with Kechari. Well, that's the first Dr. Lewis had heard of that, but then he practiced it and found it far more effective. When Dr. Lewis told me this story, I went to Master. I'd been with Master about 2 years then. I said, "Sir, should I be doing Kriya with Kechari?" Because I was able to practice Kechari. His answer was, "Not yet." So I understood from that that, in fact, it was a deliberate thing, and not just to spare the delicate sensibilities of Westerners, but it was that people need to be prepared, and that this aw and e sound is more effective in the beginning to give you that feeling in the spine. So do it for 2 or 3 years the way we've taught you, but then if you want to do Kechari, then that would be an excellent practice to do. Especially with the higher initiations, you really ought to do Kechari when you practice the higher initiations. But you'll find that once you can feel the currents, not until then, but once you can feel that current and then you practice Kechari, that's why when I'm doing Kriya with Kechari, then my mouth is closed because you're breathing through the nose. But the tongue either can touch the uvula. The uvula is that little sort of thing that hangs down, appendage that hangs down at the back of the soft palate that makes it possible for a Frenchman to say re. And you go behind that, and there are certain nerve endings in the passages behind the nose. If you can touch the tip of the tongue to that, or even having it in that position will bring it closer, you will feel an inward pull of your energy, and it's really quite effective. But don't feel that you have to do that in order to do Kriya. Master didn't teach this to many disciples, and he did it deliberately. Another comment I want to make on this, because there are some people who teach Kriya one way, some who teach it another, some who say, well, Master didn't give it the way Lahiri Maharshi did. And the answer to that is that Master gave it basically the way Lahiri Maharshi did. But he made certain changes, minor changes, but as a master, he had a right to do it. You see, if you or I were to make a change in Kriya, that would be a presumption. But if a master is doing it, he's coming from the same place Babaji came from. It's not as if being a grandson of Lahiri Maharshi spiritually, he's less than Lahiri Maharshi. It's not as if being a great-grandson of Babaji, he's less than Babaji. Once you're a liberated master, you're on the same level as all other liberated masters. In fact, I was talking with Master once about the about these different stages and so on, and he said very few of the saints that we read about, or the great masters that we read about, very few were fully liberated. Trailanga Swami, for example, I asked him about. He was this great saint in Benares who lived 300 years and had a vast reputation for sanctity and being a great master, but he wasn't fully liberated. He still had past karma to work out. He'd worked out his present state to the point where he was in complete, he was in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, but he still had that past to work out. Master said that of all the saints in the autobiography, the only ones who had final liberation were Babaji, Lahiri Maharshi, Sri Yukteswar. He didn't say himself on that occasion, but other times he said it. Pranabananda, the saint with two bodies, and Ram Gopal Mozumdar, the sleepless saint. Those were the only ones. I asked him about all the others, thinking he must have overlooked this one or that one. No, not one. I asked him about Mataji, the sister of Babaji. I said that she, her state, you've described her state as being almost as great as that of Babaji, and Master said, well, that means she wasn't there yet. But then he said, she must be by now. But the thing is that if you're a little less than Babaji, it's because you're not there. If you're there, you're as great as Babaji. They're all equally great in God. Babaji has a very particular role to play in this world, and so his role is cosmic in that sense, embracing all humanity. But as far as their inner realization goes, they have the right to speak, and when Master gave it in one way, you don't have to worry about his changing. If he wants to change, he can change it completely. That's his prerogative, because a master does what God gives him to do, what God tells him to do, and doesn't do anything else ever. But certain things that he didn't introduce, we can see from the things that he said to different disciples that he was introducing it. He wasn't excluding it. He was rather introducing it in stages so that people could pick up on it gradually. For example, this chanting Om at the chakras. When I heard him say that at an initiation, he didn't say it in the lessons, but when he said it at the initiation, he said, "But if it distracts you, don't do it." Well, that meant he was talking to beginners, and he was talking to people who had come for many years. And beginners, he thought, well, if it distracts them, and it probably will, don't do it. But he went, don't do it yet, not don't do it. And with this other technique, yes, I think many highly advanced disciples of Master don't do it at all. But if you can do it, you will find it a help, definitely. And so, if you're interested in learning how, then I or one of the ministers can teach you the technique for doing it. But I don't feel that this morning, with only 20 minutes to go, is the occasion to get into that. And I am assuming, I think with some degree of safety, that most of you won't practice it. So let's keep with what most of you will practice, since this is a class to all of you. With your practice of Kriya, then, try to go very, very deep into relaxation. If you're a little nervous, upset, worried, whatever it might be, do Hong Sa first. Do Hong Sa for as long as it takes you to get calm and centered. Listen to Om. The Om technique is something many don't do, but it's a wonderful technique. It's really the basis of everything, because Om is the basis of everything. Not the technique is the basis, but when you're in Om, you're in everything. Everything comes out of Om. Everything goes back to Om. The more you can do your meditation, the more you can do your Kriya, listening to Om. That's the way Patanjali spoke of doing it. Listening to Om and feeling yourself just as a manifestation of Om while practicing it, the more you'll find that you really get into a divine flow. Pranabananda, the saint with two bodies, pranaba means the Om sound, joy in Om. This is the basis of yoga. It's through Om that you attain Christ consciousness, through Christ consciousness that you attain cosmic consciousness. You have to go through Om. The Om technique is essential. Another thing that is important in this, and I've sort of touched on it, but not entirely directly, so let me get more direct. The attitudes that you need to have when practicing Kriya. I talked of devotional self-offering. Another one is of withdrawal. Feel that you're in this world. This is the way Lahiri Mahasaya used to say, as Master quotes him in the autobiography. Feel that you live in this world as a guest. That nothing and no one belongs to you. You belong to no one. You just are living here for a few short years. And you do your duty. You do it with love. You have your friends, your dear ones, your family, your work, all the things that you enjoy, but there's a little part of you that's always a part, knows that I could leave this just like that. And what I take with me is all that I have, all that I am. I can't take any of that. So live in this. And then have a watchful attitude. Feel as if there was a part of you that was observing everything. So that you reach that point where nothing ruffles you. You have to have that if you're going to do Kriya. Kriya itself helps to calm you. You know, if the reactive process is you get excited by something and the energy comes up, you get depressed by something and the energy comes down, then we find in Kriya the way of getting control over that process. Because you deliberately bring the energy up. That way you can control your reactions to things so that nothing can really upset you anymore. So that when things are likely to make you happy, you relate that happiness to the inside and realize that it's feeding your inner wellsprings of joy rather than taking you out into this lovely experience so that you can enjoy everything much more. It's not as if a yogi became a zombie. It's that you enjoy really, because excitement is not joy. In the Bhagavad Gita it says, how can restless people be happy? In the point of view of that culture, restlessness and excitement are the opposite of happiness. But in our culture, we say, oh, I'm so excited, I'm going to Alaska next month. Well, that shouldn't be exciting. It should be it should be something that makes you happy inside, not outside, so you don't get up and excited. But Kriya is one of the best ways, if not the best way, of achieving the state of equanimity that is yoga. When you can calm these waves in the mind, when you can calm your reactive process, when you can overcome your likes and dislikes so that you just accept whatever is, then you can act upon things and make them better. It's not as if you become indifferent, but you can act responsibly instead of as a mere echo to whatever is going on outside yourself. And so now, with this practice of Kriya then, you want to have absolute control over these currents. The watchful state helps you to get that control because it helps you to understand, to realize that your reaction is here, it's not out there. It's not that you're reacting to, it's that you're reacting with. And you would react to just about anything as long as that inner reaction was there. That's why one man's meat is another man's poison. As long as you're in a mood to get excited, anything will excite you. As long as you're in a mood to get depressed, anything will depress you. As long as you're in a mood to be happy, anything will make you happy. It all starts here, but if you get control over here, you're achieving yoga. So living here as a guest, as a visitor, being watchful, and always remembering that sooner or later, and it will be very soon, even if it's another 80 years, very soon, the older you get, the faster it seems to go by. This life is just like that, and it's gone. So keep your mind fixed where you're going. Don't forget your goal. That's why, again, in Kriya, keep your mind fixed here. That's why you keep your eyes up while doing Kriya, because you're doing it with reference to this point, even though your mind, your energy come up and down. Now then, another point is the... I should just touch briefly on counting Kriya. You know, the Kriya beads are a very easy way to count. Should you count? Yes. We do Kriya in segments of 12. This today and yesterday, I haven't had the time to get into the whole thing that Master got into in Autobiography of a Yogi, the correlation between Kriya and the zodiac, the outward and the inward astrology. It's a fascinating subject, but it would take a lecture in itself, and it's somewhat theoretical, but here's the point I want to touch on at the moment. We go forward in our evolution in 12-year cycles. If you'll look back over your life, you'll probably see that at 12, 24, 36, 48, 60, these are important years in a person's life spiritually. And he may go through a lot of testing just before that birthday, or it may be some great awakening. But if you look back, a lot of people have told me that this has been so for them. It's certainly been so for me, that these are years in which you sort of make a new leap, a new change, spiritually speaking. The cycles of work are to do with Saturn, but the cycles of inner growth are to do with the cycles of Jupiter, which takes 12 years to go around the zodiac, around your horoscope, once. And so, Guru, in the Indian astrological system, Guru is Jupiter. Jupiter stands for the Guru because the word for Jupiter in Sanskrit is Brihaspati, who was the Guru of the gods in their mythology. So Guru and Jupiter are actually considered one. And the Guru's help in the practice of Kriya, this is why Kriya has to be given in initiation, otherwise it's just a mechanical exercise. But with the adjunction of the Guru's blessings, the Guru's help, that's why it's so important to invoke those blessings before you practice the meditation, practice your Kriya. But that, you do cycles of 12 in Kriya because that's the natural rhythm. And any increase, Master said first do 14, and he said the first and last don't count. I think that was his way of just giving you two to get into it. But after that, he increased it in segments of 12 each. So from 14, 24, 36, 48, 60, up to 108. How many Kriyas should you do? Well, it depends on how well you do them. If you're doing them well and can do 108, good. if you're doing them not well, better do fewer and do them well. Don't concentrate on number, concentrate on quality. As you increase in increments of 12. But if you're finding that today you're not doing Kriya well, then do fewer. Never do fewer than 14, just to keep the habit going. But try to make it more. If, on the other hand, you find that you're not doing your Kriyas well and you're doing 48 Kriyas, cut back to 14 again, or 24, let's say, and do a few, and try to concentrate on really getting deep into it, doing Hong Sa, doing Om, getting really focused before you begin your Kriya. When you're really calm, when you're really centered, then see if Kriya is not more effective for you. Now, what are you doing with your progress or progression of these different techniques? First, you're doing Mahamudra. That magnetizes the spine. It gets the energy moving toward the spine. Then you do Kriya. That gets it centered in the spine. Now, is that enough to be centered in the spine? No. After that, you want to bring the energy here. This is the doorway to the infinite. This is the point where, through which, the spiritual eye, through which you go into the infinite. And so Jyoti Mudra is very important. Even if you don't see the light, it's good to see the light. In fact, you should, even if you see the light, that's not enough. You should practice until you can go through the light, go through that spiritual eye, into the gold, which is the astral world, into the blue, which is the causal world, through the star in the center, which is the consciousness of the cosmic consciousness of God beyond creation. But even if you don't see anything, doing Jyoti Mudra will help to bring your mind here after Kriya, and that's where it should be, so that you've got your Kriya, centering your Kriya, bringing it here with Jyoti Mudra, then you're ready to go into deep meditation. Now, you don't prepare a meal and walk away from it. That's the time to meditate. After you've got your Kriya done, after you've got your mind here, then meditate. It's important, because at that point, that's when your Kriya has prepared the meal, and if you go deep, you'll be able to really benefit from your meditation. That's when intuition develops. By deepening your sense of peace, deepening your enjoyment of peace after the practice of the techniques. So, now another thing about the light. If you don't see the light, you will find that if you can completely relax, and relax your emotions also from all attachment, all upset, the more completely relaxed you are inside on a physical, emotional, and mental level, the more that light will come clear. So, even in doing Jyoti Mudra, don't make it a tense thing. You squeeze the openings in the sense of using the fingers to remind you to withdraw the energy and relax it at this point. The more you can live all day with your mind centered here, the more rapid your spiritual progress will be. And so, your step-by-step process in Kriya that you should be following is relaxation, all of it. Relaxation from attachment, relaxation from the body, relaxation into the spine, relaxation from the spine to the spiritual eye, relaxation in the sense of self-offering, not with effort. Remember, fighting on the spiritual plane means withdrawal and refocusing. It doesn't mean tension. It doesn't mean stabbing with a sword. Offering yourself up in the deep relaxation of devotion and concentration, and then you will go into the deeper states. Now let me just look and see whether there are questions here that I haven't touched on. I know I've touched on quite a few, and so I won't repeat those. What is the function of feeling the cool and warm breath? The function is that that's how the breath actually feels when you feel it deeply. Master said these truths are discoverable by anyone. It's not that you have to go to yoga to learn it, although a long tradition makes these things much clearer. But somebody in India told me he read something written by one of the Russian mystics, who, you know, they practice the prayer of Jesus, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy upon me. And he said, practice it, Lord Jesus Christ, inhaling and bringing the breath up. And then have mercy upon me, bring the breath down, as you say those words. And he said, you will feel a cool current on the left side of the spine as you inhale and a warm current as you exhale. Interesting, huh? Should I be concerned about occasional shivers in my spine during Kriya or meditation? Sometimes they may be a little startling or violent. These are natural functions of the energy, which you'll get controlled over. Just be more relaxed. Don't worry about it. It happens. It's a result of a certain amount of tension, too. And the more you completely relax, the more that will pass away. I've been reading books on our different masters by another Swami. I get confused because of the differences. I would say you have a great master, follow that. There is a lot that's written, a lot that's said. I've read some of it, and I haven't been impressed, actually. The vibrations were wrong, and so on. But the fact is, anyway, we've got a great master and a line of great masters behind us. If we follow with devotion, there's no point in reading a lot of other things. All we do is get confused. That's why Master said, be concentrated on your own. It gives you everything you need. Would you give any suggestions for helping to achieve breath becomes mind? I talked a lot about that yesterday. I think I'll leave it there. I answered that one. Amori, would you come here and hold this for me so it's easier for me to... Thank you. Counting Kriya's left or right hand, it strictly depends on whether you're left or right-handed. It doesn't matter. The way, if you count on your fingers, the way they teach in India is use the segments. 1, 2, 3, 4... 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 is the way they do it, but because we do 12, 11, 12. And then on the left hand you can do 1 cycle, 2 cycle, 3 cycle if you want to go on further. Kriya beads are easier, but it's up to you. Some of us have developed a bad habit of letting the eyes go up and down with inhalation and exhalation. What's the way to kick this habit? Break the habit is the way they put it. I said that. Keep the mind focused here and realize that you're doing it with reference to here, so the eyes automatically stay there. If you have difficulty, though, practice Kriya with half-open eyes and just doing it like that. And it'll be easier for you to keep the eyes there. When I feel the energy, it's in a much more general way. It'll become more particularized as you relax more deeply and concentrate more deeply. Yes, it's good to visualize that it's passing the chakras. I talked about that this morning already. I answered that today. How close are the physical spine and the astral spine? Well, I told you, he says, sometimes I feel the energy going up in front of the physical spine, which leads to a stronger feeling of pressure at the spiritual eye and a brighter light. It is in front of what most people think of as their spine, because they think of the backbone here as the spine. But the vertebral column is what we're talking about, not the backbone. And that's more in front. So this is correct. Why do we limit Kriya initiation to devotees of this path? Well, because the blessing of the masters is initiation. It's not just a technique. It's a very important thing. Most people think that they can learn anything out of a book, but anybody who wants to become good at anything goes to a real teacher of it. He doesn't just get it out of books. It's a very basic part of Indian tradition, and I think they knew what they were talking about, and I don't say that merely with dogma, but from my own experience, I've observed that people who, even who do Kriya on their own but don't come here or don't come to SRF, they don't get nearly as much out of it as those who come frequently, get into spiritual vibrations, practice satsang, have that outward contact as well as the inward contact as much as possible. Could we not as a group consciously include in our meditations more than incidental prayers for the world and souls in need? Yes, in fact, we recommend that, but that's up to you, how you feel. But certainly to send blessings out to the world, it's not incidental if you do it with real depth. People who practice this sending of Om actually help greatly the people for whom they're praying. And more than that, well, just that depends upon your own inspiration. Master said, I did not come to the West to start a new religion, and this is not a new sect. Shouldn't we give it to all? Well, I answered that. We're willing to give it to all, but they have to get it in the way that they'll get it. There's no point if I had $1 million, I could give $1 to each of 1 million people, and they'd probably not be able to afford a cup of coffee. Whereas if I use that million to build a beautiful chapel here, for example, or a temple somewhere, or some good project that many people benefit, that's concentrated that money energy, and it's doing much more good with it. And so also with the good that we're doing spiritually, if we scatter it abroad, we're not doing any good to anybody. Whereas if we focus it and give it in the right way, then the blessing is much, much greater. For the last year, I have been experiencing much restlessness after Kriya and in daily activities. This is quite unusual in my 7 years as a Kriyaban. I've not been sitting long after doing Kriya. Could you say more about sitting? Well, I've said quite a bit about that. But the other, there's an interesting expression Master had, karmic bums of restlessness. That you go along perfectly peacefully and suddenly you're restless. It's because some karma has come out. You don't see it clearly enough, and so you can't objectify it, you can't define it, but it's there. And remember, Master even had that the very day Sri Yukteswar gave him samadhi, remember? And he was so restless he couldn't meditate well. Don't worry about it. This will happen. It sometimes goes on for a long time, depending on the strength of that particular karma. But if you keep it up, then it will gradually go away. As I said, for 1.5 years, I hated Kriya. Really disliked it intensely, and did it because I'd promised to, and did it because I had faith that Master knew what he was doing, and did it because, frankly, I saw no alternative. I couldn't see going back to a worldly life. This was it. And so I just had to do whatever was necessary to get me through. But you'll find that it'll pass. This is about something we've talked about. So, thank you. All right, thank you very much.